A work by Malcolm Nabarro, Lincoln Green, and the composer was conducting the East of England Orchestra, tribute to lovely, lovely Lincolnshire.
This is 89.3 FM WHFR Radio, the station making waves here at Henry Ford Community College. Hope you're enjoying this beautiful programming, and please check out some of the other exciting formats that we offer here on WHFR, particularly during these summer months. If you're interested in trying something a little more, well, let's say rock and roll, well, we've got plenty of that. Lots of great blues and jazz and, oh gosh, just a little bit of everything, including some spoken word. That's right. We have some great talk programs airing Saturday mornings right here from 10 until 11. And then, of course, it's the WHFR Journal, the new WHFR Journal, Friday afternoons at 1. And let's not forget those old-time radio mysteries, classic radio mysteries from days gone by, Monday evenings 11 until the midnight hour. And so much more right here on WHFR. Big band and world music and everything in between.
The following program has been pre-recorded. The views expressed by the participants are not necessarily those of WHFR Radio or Henry Ford Community College. Welcome to We Are Not Alone. Where local investigators as well as world-renowned scientists and ufologists share their latest evidence in support of the UFO reality. Hi, I'm David Twitchell, and you're listening to WHFR Dearborn. WHFR.fm is the station making waves, and for the next hour, we will be exploring the mysteries of the UFO and abduction phenomenon. In May of 2008, Mr. Peter Robbins was our guest on this show, and I'm happy to say we were able to get him back for today's show. And Peter is one of the most respected investigative writers and public speakers on the subject of UFOs. He has more than 30 years experience as a researcher, investigator, writer, lecturer, activist, and author. And he is a regular guest on radio shows around the country. And he has appeared on or been consultant to numerous television shows and documentaries. He is also the co-author of the British bestseller, Left at East Gate, a first-hand account of the Rendlesham Forest UFO incident, its cover-up and investigation. So I want to welcome Mr. Peter Robbins back to the show.
David, thank you so much for inviting me back to the show.
It is our pleasure. And coming up here shortly in November, you're going to be at the... in beautiful Las Vegas, Nevada, aren't you?
I am. The most unnatural place on the entire planet.
We don't want to call it that, do we?
I mean that with great affection. I live most of my life in the middle of New York City, so who am I to talk?
It is unnatural. Right out in the middle of the desert, nowhere.
Fascinating.
Nowhere USA, except, my goodness.
But it is, in fact, one of my favorite annual conferences, and one I've been fortunate enough to speak at most of them. We have coming up the weekend of the 6th through the 8th of November, the 7th annual Crash Retrieval Conference, always extremely well organized by my dear friend and colleague Ryan Wood.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, we had Ryan Wood on the show a while back. We talked a little bit about crash retrievals, but what kind of... I assume you have some evidence or documentation to present at that at that conference in November?
Well, I do, but as usual for me, it really isn't about crashes or retrievals. Most of the participants, of course, do stick to topic. Ryan, bless his heart, likes my work and lets me weasel in with things that are not necessarily overtly related to crashes, and this year will be no exception.
Okay.
In fact, Ryan's given me a wonderful opportunity. Normally, I do a talk of an hour and 15 minutes, as most speakers do for conferences, but this year, Ryan has asked me to prepare two shorter talks, which I will probably use to scale up next year for full-length talks. And they're both UFO-related subjects that not so much have been ignored, but have kind of just been left in the footnote category for many years. And for me, I have a personal connection with both of them. The first is going to be a reevaluation of Russia's best-known close encounter incident that took place in 1989 in a city called Voronezh, which is about 800 miles southwest of Moscow.
Mm.
I'm also going to talk about particulars of and my personal memories of the 1978 United Nations effort to establish a permanent UN UFO agency, which I worked at basically as a young editorial assistant on a paper for then Secretary General Waldheim, and had the unique opportunity to sit in on all of the relevant meetings of the Special Political Committee of the General Assembly.
Okay, now J. Allen Hynek and Stanton Friedman, Dr. Jacques Vallée, astronaut Gordon Cooper, they were all at that 78 committee.
Well, they all were, with one exception. Gordon Cooper was indeed scheduled to speak there, but New York was hit by a phenomenal blizzard over those couple of days, and he was actually not able to get into town.
Okay.
But his statement was, and was read very much into the record at the time.
Okay.
But yeah, we had some of the major luminaries of ufology, as well as a gentleman associated with certainly then an extremely well-known case. He is a lieutenant colonel, as I recall, named Coyne, C-O-Y-N-E.
Okay.
And his helicopter, which was being operated with a crew near its base in Ohio, was pulled higher and higher into the sky by a UFO, very much against the will of the crew and the pilot.
Mm.
And he was right there as a first-hand witness to talk about it. It was extremely interesting, to put it mildly. Fascinating couple of days.
And how did these people in the UN take this kind of information?
This is absolutely subjective, because it's based on, quite literally, David, looking at the faces of the representatives to the United Nations who were there for their countries. And they were all not there. There was certainly a noticeable absence level. And judging from the reactions of the personnel who were there, my sense was because this was the last place they wanted to be discussing the last subject they would want to discuss in an open forum.
Mm.
Let's remember the tremendous ridicule value that's been associated with this subject since the summer of 1947.
Right.
And my sense was that none of these representatives wanted to jeopardize their cushy jobs and their New York apartments and their nice salaries by going and reporting back to their representative governments that flying saucers are real and we ought to take them seriously. The entire motion was brought forth by the leader of one of the then smallest countries in the world, the Republic of Grenada in the Caribbean, who was overthrown in a coup shortly after. That was Sir Eric Gehry. And this was a very passionate interest of his. And ultimately, it did pass and became an actual issue to consider, and then, not surprisingly, was allowed to die slowly in committee. So it never happened, but it came fairly close, and one wonders if things would be the same now. I do not know.
I do not know either. It seems like, you know, we're supposed to now with President Obama, he promises transparency. Just last month I did a show on UFOs and U.S. presidents and mentioned Obama being the guy that's supposed to let us all know the truth. And we're still waiting on this one. Of course, I realize he's got a lot on his plate, you know.
Yeah, and you bring up a point that is on my mind a lot these days. In fact, last month I spoke at the 40th annual International MUFON UFO Symposium, which was held in Denver, and I presented the spoken version of a long paper that I've been working on for many months, the title of which is Politics, Religion, and Human Nature, Practical Problems and Roadblocks on the Path Toward Official UFO Acknowledgement. And it addressed some of these questions. Frankly, for all of the notable efforts of folks who were letting the White House know over these months how seriously they take this issue and how much they want the government to consider declassifying and making public the information we have, I think it's extremely unrealistic to hope that it is going to happen, certainly in the next few years, because as you know, well, in overdrive, few presidents have entered office with more on their plate than our current occupant.
All right.
And I'm remembering back to the Watergate hearings, and for any of your listeners who are in the field or studying the subject of UFOs at the time, they may have been privy to a brief but very potent rumor that swept the research community as former President Nixon's, well, then President Nixon's career was swirling down the drain, that there was some talk that in order to take attention off of his political problems and the fact that he was in the process of being, all things considered, forced from office, that he was actually considering doing just this and releasing information. Of course, it never happened.
No.
I think the ultimate irony is that it probably wouldn't have been a bad idea. It certainly is one of the very few things that would have presented us with a larger problem than the one we were contemplating.
Right.
And possibly a move to keep the president we have now that we're in this national and, by extension, international crisis. And I don't know. For me, it's just politics. It has nothing to do with the ongoing cover-up, and I feel that's very real.
Yeah.
The timing is just not good, and even if he perseveres over the next few years and we're pulled out of the economic decline we're in and the Middle East stabilizes some, can you imagine the hue and cry that would go up if word got out in the media that the president took seriously the idea of UFOs from other planets? And I think a lot of people would be on his case in no uncertain terms from the left and the right, that it's an evasive tactic, and, you know, why are you even bringing this up?
Yeah. Well, it's one...
Again, history may certainly prove me wrong, but I think quite a number of our colleagues and friends are going to be frustrated that their efforts really don't produce anything that they can see or that is tangible in the next months or for this term of office.
Yeah, it's one thing to say I'm interested in this subject, I'm curious about this subject, et cetera, et cetera. And it's another to come out and say, my fellow Americans, we are not alone in the universe.
Well, you're absolutely right there.
And once that Pandora's box is open, there's no closing it.
Yeah, yeah, you got that right. And I think if we were in more stable times, and there was a respectable percentage of the population that felt the way that many of us do, maybe we would be able to edge into that time more realistically right now. If we are, it's happening in a totally covert way, and that's not out of the question either. Also, we no longer and have not for many years lived in a time where I think any one nation can definitively make this announcement on its own. I think this is something that will call for tremendous coordination between world leaders and world governments and a great deal of study and planning prior to.
Yeah, but there's so many countries now, the UK, France, Colombia, I just can't name them all.
Denmark, Sweden, Belgium, I think Portugal, a number of South American countries. No, you're absolutely right.
And to some degree,
many of the things that they have released are provocative, fascinating, and lead us to taking this subject more seriously and giving us a great deal more information.
Right.
But none of these nations have gone beyond this very healthy process of declassifying online,
right,
which I wish we would do. I don't think that would be the biggest deal in the world, and also might assuage a certain number of us and be at least a gesture of goodwill. But nobody has gone beyond that and said, based on this, we now put our national reputation on the line and say some of these phenomena are representative of advanced technology and other intelligences from parts unknown that come and go with impunity.
Mm-hmm.
And that seems appropriate, too, because if one nation were to do it on their own, the same way if one person does it on their own, they tend to look, well, really far out and extreme, and what a quirky character they are, or what a quirky nation. But imagine if all of those nations next week coordinated announcements from their world leaders saying just that, and taking it one step further, saying this is not a criticism of first world nations and America at the lead who have not done this, but we feel for a number of reasons we can no longer keep mum on this subject. And in so many words, the information we have released through official Defense Department or equivalent websites do point to this possibility, that cadre, that league, not to confuse it with the original precursor to the UN, but the League of Nations will really, again, have to do this together to do it properly. And that, of course, brings up a lot of complex questions about how best to go about it. In this paper, I set up a certain hypothetical scenario as to one way it can be accomplished. But even that is completely out of my imagination and education, because it's based on the president taking the initiative. And is a president even capable of doing that? Would they be allowed to do that? How much does any president know? Most of us feel that, since Truman at the least, presidents have been briefed on a need-to-know basis, and probably the forces that be feel the less they need to know, the better.
That's right, and that's the thing. I can understand the president, even if he wanted to come out with, with this information, he can't do it unless somebody says, you know, this is real, and here's the evidence. Because even if he believed that this is true, even if he had a personal sighting, as Carter had, as Reagan had, you know, he could not come forward and say this unless he was told for sure by the proper authorities. And they're just simply not going to tell him.
No. Plus, you know, no matter how much power or respect or dislike or influence any sitting president has, they are a temporary occupant of an office where a certain aspect of the flow of information, and this I think is a great example, is controlled by we don't even know who. Certainly people who are not elected, but who are very powerful, deeply entrenched bureaucrats who in their own way may control not as much of the flow of information as they did in the 1940s. It's not out of the question that a certain amount of the real clout now comes from multinationals, and the people that basically fund presidential elections and swing the power to make elections. We live in such a new world now, and I'm actually edging into another topic, which is my good friend and colleague, Rich Dolan, who for the last few years, we've all been increasingly waiting for part two of his extraordinary work, UFOs in the National Security State.
Oh, yeah, Richard Dolan, yeah.
And it is at the printer now. The first books may actually be back. It's coming in at about 600-plus pages. Mm-hmm. I have had the privilege of reading quite a bit of it in galleys, and I think Rich has done a remarkable job picking up where he left off in the initial volume, and this one will go from 73 to 91. But he does weave in a great deal of thought about the powers that be and who controls the purse strings and how are black projects funded and what are the connections between corporate America and classified projects.
You just said it. You just said it, Peter.
It's, you know, a conundrum within a riddle within a question.
You just said it. Corporate America, that's who pulls the strings. That's who pulls the strings. We're going to have to take a short break right now to remind our listeners that you're listening to WHFR.FM, the station making waves. I'm David Twitchell. You're listening to We Are Not Alone, and we're speaking with author and UFO researcher Peter Robbins. Mr. Robbins, you are presently, in fact, on this day that is this being aired, you're in Exeter, New Hampshire.
I am.
Yeah, and giving a lecture on the power of ridicule versus Okay, I'm going to say it again. Why do you have such long titles in these things? is that the book or the first chapter, for goodness sake? You say it.
Yes, the power of ridicule versus a most uncomfortable truth. Yes, I'm in beautiful Exeter, New Hampshire this weekend, and this is the town of Exeter's very first attempt at what we hope will be an annual UFO festival and conference. Mm-hmm. And it's wonderful being here, and my topic is one of particular interest to me, namely, how did it come about that the subject of UFOs and their implications became so loaded with ridicule and are almost a shorthand for, you know, being mentally ill or unstable or a trickster? Mm-hmm. What I'm doing in this talk is working on a timeline beginning in late June 1947, the week of the Kenneth Arnold sightings in the Cascade Mountain Range in Washington, and then, of course, within days, the events at Roswell, and looking at news coverage of the time, mostly from the venerable New York Times, and then contrasting it on a timeline with actual photographs, witness testimony, and more important, selections from the thousands of pages of compelling, authentically declassified government documents that point out how real this is. Essentially, we've been done a great disservice as a nation. We have been brilliantly conditioned, and most of our citizens still are, to react with a certain amount of
disdain.
Yes, disdain and humor when we hear those three magic letters, when we should be taking them, if anything, extremely seriously.
Yeah.
I'm delighted that I'm getting a chance to refine this talk here, and some of my good colleagues here include Kathleen Martin, who wrote the wonderful book, Captured, the Betty and Barney Hill UFO Experience with Stan Friedman.
Yeah.
And as many of your listeners know, Kathleen is Betty Hill's niece and probably knows more about the case than anybody alive except maybe Stan.
Mm-hmm.
My friend, old friend Peter Jeremiah of New Hampshire MUFON, Ted Loader discussing the Disclosure Project, and one or two other speakers. But we're wishing them the best, and we hope that this is something that can happen on a yearly basis here in Exeter.
Right. So the subtitle of your talk is Why We Need to Take UFOs Seriously.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes,
yeah.
Indeed. As a defense issue, as an issue, of course, that is of paradigm importance to the human race, because of all of the implications it signals for all of us. and because, in fact, it's a subject that deserves a historical correction. Mm-hmm. I don't know how else to say it.
Now, ABC, television network, just had a show on the other day, a couple weeks back here, on what am I trying to say? Well, the abduction phenomenon.
Yeah.
They call them the outsiders. And it was very, very predictable in the network shows. They give the mystery for, you know, catch the audience's attention.
Yeah.
And work them all up. Isn't this strange, for the first 40 minutes. And then they spend the last 20 minutes of the hour debunking it.
How frustrating.
Yeah.
I was actually in an area without a television at the time.
Oh.
In a very remote part of Oregon, speaking at a scientific conference there, and did not get to see it, but your observations, I'm sorry to say, don't surprise me.
Yeah.
I'm sure you remember, I guess it's now 4 or 5 years ago, it was the last thing that the late Peter Jennings worked on.
Mm.
And that was also purported to be an expose
right.
of the subject. And
same thing.
Yeah. In great part, the omissions were so noticeable, excluding the fact that there are all kinds of physical evidence and multiple witnessing to these type of events, was just the wrong thing to do. My feeling is, don't do it if you're going to have to lie about it at the end. There seems to be this tremendous approach avoidance relationship with the media about the abduction phenomena, and goodness knows that makes all the sense in the world. It's fascinating and absolutely chilling, and very much at the center, I think, of the whole UFO phenomena. I don't know when we're going to see a really honest and accurate program on the subject. But
well, there are documentaries done by ufologists that But and I must admit that they're pretty one-sided. I love to hear the debunkers come out, and like the James McGaha.
What a pinhead. Sorry, I have no respect for him at all.
He says things like, he was on Larry King.
Oh, boy.
And, I'm not going to give you the guy's name now from the Rendlesham Forest. You should know. He said he went out and he touched the thing. Colonel Halt?
Oh, yes. It would have been Jim Peniston.
Peniston.
Yes.
And Jim Peniston. And he says, I went out and touched the thing. And he says, well, I'd be skeptical about that.
Oh, God.
Are you calling him a liar?
A liar to his face.
Yeah. Are you calling a man a liar? And, you know, and then they talk about these. Now, bear in mind that McGaha was a pilot, right?
Yeah.
And he says, there are so many pilot observations. These are trained observers.
Yeah.
And McGaha says, pilots aren't trained to observe, they're trained to fly. Now you and I are flying a plane, and you say to me, Dave, you know, this UFO.
Keep your eyes open.
You know, what was that? What was that that just came in front of us? Well, don't ask me, Pete. I'm just trained to fly here.
You know, that kind of condescension, again, I have so little patience for. This man has nothing to do with healthy, intelligent skepticism, something we should all be on the case about. He's a professional hitman. He's a debunker.
Mm-hmm.
His operative mantra has got to be something like, it can't be, therefore it isn't.
Therefore it isn't.
It's something else. And that choice, of course, includes fakers, misunderstandings, mentally ill people, people who want to be on talk shows, like himself.
Yeah. Yeah.
No, it's, and you know, I like Larry King. I admire the fact that he's one of the very few people in the major media who consistently and for years keeps this subject in the public eye. And you want to pull your hair out because, you know, his producer is saying something like, but Larry, in order to be fair, we've got to have, you know, somebody like McGaha on. And that's like saying, in order to, it's not being fair at all. You're having somebody on who simply has no real familiarity with the scholarly material, has never really studied it,
right,
and who, again, has an agenda. I think one of the things that has made me a fairly good investigative writer is I have a secret trick, namely that I've never gone into an investigation with an agenda. And that includes Left at East Gate. I mean, if that case had blown up in my face 4, 5, 7, 8, 10 years into investigating it, gee, that would have been very embarrassing.
Mm-hmm.
But if somebody can give me a credible explanation for what happened in those woods in England in 1980 and what those American Air Force personnel and British observers saw and were privy to, you know, and can make the case for me, great, good work. I'm not going to lose any sleep over it.
Right.
But nobody's been able to do that. And this is representative of the worst kind of reporting. And I wish that shows like King's would not feel the need to bring on a professional jerk like him. And if they are going to bring on a counterpoint, at least let it be somebody who has some kind of credentials and respectability to allow them to be a good debating person.
Well, they brought on Jim Nye, the science guy with the bow tie.
Another one. I mean, again, these are professional entertainers on a certain level. I'm reminded of Carl Sagan, who in his very early work was very courageous about this point of view of extraterrestriality and visitations, and confided to different people I've known over the years that was not a subject that he did not still find worthy of respect. But I think he became Carl Sagan, the official scientist of American television and popular culture.
Mm-hmm.
And at that point, you know, like Freud in his early theories on sexuality, he was Freud.
Mm-hmm.
And you can't, you know, be a good middle-class icon if you hold on to those early wild views of yours.
Right, right. He was more open about it in his earlier days,
yeah.
Sagan was, yeah. But he quickly learned that that's not the direction to go to keep your funding.
Well, you know, bingo.
Stay alive,
I think that's a huge part of it. And you bring up a very important point, David, which is in putting together my paper for MUFON, I came upon a wonderful quote by Dr. James E. McDonald, one of my ufological heroes and atmospheric physicist with the University of Arizona, who really devoted a tremendous amount of his career to try and have this subject become legitimate in the eyes of the scientific community and went down trying. And the quote was to the effect of, the scientific community has no significant data on the subject of UFOs because they don't believe the subject is real and they won't study the data. It's much like the youth of 20 who can't get a job and doesn't have the experience that will allow them to go out and get the job.
Right.
And that is the rope they still tow.
And kind of like the Galileo's sunspots, you know, go ahead and, you know, take a look through my telescope and see the sunspots for yourself. No, they can't be, so why should I waste my time looking at the evidence?
Yeah, don't bother me with the facts. My mind's made up.
Yeah, that's one of Sam Friedman's favorite ones.
How depressing.
Yeah.
Well, but true.
But this show on abduction, they had our favorite gal, Susan Clancy, on there.
Oh, dear.
From Harvard University.
Yeah.
And she took over immediately after
John Max
untimely passing.
I don't think she would have opened her mouth if John had not been killed by that drunken cab driver named.
Yeah, I probably not, because John Mack was the authority, and he was. But she sure is opening her mouth now.
Well,
and it's all sleep paralysis.
I know.
Well, you know,
all of it. Gee whiz. Huh?
Yeah. Well, you know, that may be part of the, you know, some people have sleep paralysis.
Yes,
I understand
it is a
that.
Diagnosable, actual,
certainly,
real condition. But as part of it, you don't absolutely see aliens in your bedroom or experience being floated through hard objects and taken aboard craft.
My sister has been part of the abduction phenomenon since childhood, and she wrote to me today, and she said, that woman, well, we won't say what she said about that woman. She said, you know, I have seen them when I was fully awake in my bedroom.
Yes.
She had an experience where she walked into the bedroom, and the lights were off, and yet her room was filled with this brilliant light. And she stood there trying to figure out, in the doorway, trying to figure out where this light was coming from. And in a snap, she was sitting at the end of her bed. She hadn't even gone to bed.
Dear.
You know? And so, and that, well, this is frontal lobe epilepsy.
Yeah.
You know, you know, if there's a doctor out there who knows the difference, please let me know.
Well, but there are doctors, you know, out there who, in fact, do know the difference, and
certainly
a number of them
have
gotten into being doctors because they grew up with similar experiences. And
epilepsy doesn't have that kind of you know, people who have these seizures don't remember anything about.
No,
their
we're talking about completely distinct phenomena here, and I know if you have listeners who are maybe not regular listeners and to whom this is a new subject, then you and I must sound certifiable talking about this stuff in reasoned tones as something that we feel is absolutely real.
Mm-hmm.
But having immersed myself in it for some decades and for certainly well over a dozen years, worked as the assistant to Bud Hopkins as he explored hundreds of cases like this.
Mm-hmm.
It's not even something that I can say I believe in anymore. I've simply seen too much credible evidence,
mm-hmm.
Including, again, physical evidences in the form of implants, small cauterized marks on people's bodies that appear in the course of these events. I've spent time with other family members where, given permission, have seen parts of case histories documented by their therapist or gynecologist or professionals that they've worked with. And I'm assuming that your sister's experience was an impetus or the reason that you got involved and interested in this subject.
Actually, it was a sighting in 1962, and my listeners, my loyal listeners, are going to be saying, oh, he's going to tell that story again. I'll give you the short version.
Okay.
Clear night sky through a pinhole in the sky, about 500 feet in the sky, a craft emerged that was large enough to cover the whole city block in rolling smoke. And it sat there for 15 minutes. And my mother thought it was the second coming of Jesus Christ.
Oh, my.
My father had lived in Alaska for a couple years and had seen the northern lights. My mother was raised in Upper Michigan. She'd seen the northern lights. And yet, the official explanation was the Northern Lights. So, and even I as a kid knew that what the Northern Lights looked like. And I said, that's a craft with huge round floodlights of different colors, you know. And you hear this a lot, too. The brilliant light that was coming from that craft never illuminated the ground. It's like it was in a different time zone. And it may well have been. So, yeah, that's what got my interest. And if I hadn't had that sighting, I probably would be with Susan Clancy right now. you know,
trying to figure out what is it that makes these people so damn crazy.
I just don't know.
Well, you know, our stories run strangely parallel, David. My late sister Helen was an abductee, and we had an overwhelming childhood sighting at about the same era. During the day, and it was so I was so unable to deal with it that I didn't, and it became my suppressed memory from childhood and didn't come up for many years, but when it did, there was no putting that puppy back in the box, and my life changed overnight, quite literally.
So you couldn't wrap your mind around it, eh?
No. I was a very straight kid, and, you know, at 14 years old, I was on the final edges of a Leave It to Beaver type existence. You know, I'm not like some inner city tough guy. I grew up, and I was still in the Boy Scouts at that point. I collected rocks, bugs, and stamps. I was not into sports. I cooked, which I still do very well, I might add. But I was a reader, a painter, and these things nobody had prepared me for. I'd certainly seen, you know, my share of wonderful B-movies from the 50s and 60s, but these were real, and they were round, and they were fully articulated. Helen and I could even make out regular detailing on their edges, which we could only read the way you'd see windows on a plane. And they were in a very precise formation and hung over our house for several minutes, which is forever in UFO time.
Right.
But I know. I mean, I remember my thoughts and relived it over the years three times with three different regressive hypnotists to confirm my memories and to try to shake anything loose besides my conscious memories, which I've never been able to do. But I knew that if I talked about this to any of my junior high school buddies, word would go out, and to be radio friendly, I would never have a girlfriend in my life.
Right.
And I'll leave it at that.
I understand.
But it concerned me, and I got on with my life, and again, years later, the memory came back with a vengeance for a number of reasons that I'm pretty clear about why, but, you know, then we discussed it, and my sister remembered it without my giving her a lead line and just sort of setting the scene and saying I wanted to know what her memory was. And, yeah, the next day I started to pay increasing attention to this subject and read and turn my life around in a way that I was not really interested in doing. But this compulsion was stronger than my career track, and here I am all these years later.
And how old were you at that time?
I was, it was in my late 20s that the memory returned.
No, and, how old were you when you had your sighting?
About 14 or so.
I was 14 at the time. Well, we're almost twins.
Well, this is spooky.
I'll tell you.
Okay, I'll be going now. Bye.
I have scared Peter Robbins away.
Good work.
God, I'm good, huh? I'm going to have to take one more break to let our listeners know that you're listening to WHFR.FM, the only station making waves, and you're listening to We Are Not Alone. I'm David Twitchell, and we're speaking with Peter Robbins, author and UFO researcher and a UFO witness at the age of 14, like yours truly. Who has a sister, like I have a sister, who, and yada, yada, yada. So, now, you're talking about a leading question, and you're talking about hypnosis. This was another question that came up on this show the other night. The fact or the implication that hypnotists lead their witnesses into, you know, in other words, planting false memories in their mind. How do you answer that?
Well, number one, I'm sure there are unscrupulous and unethical people who have mastered this technique who may be capable of doing something that loathsome. But first, let's be careful here and remind ourselves that to accuse somebody of doing this is libelous. I find it unconscionable that people that have never seen individuals work will simply just say that that's the case. The best two examples I'm aware of are my good friends and colleagues Bud Hopkins and Dr. David Jacobs at Temple University. Both of them have become, well, certainly the two best known, if not two of the best known people in the field, and certainly leading pioneers. Bud, in a way, created this area of study in so many words. And I have not watched David conduct hypnotic regressions, but I've certainly sat in on many dozens that Bud has done over the years. And first, there's never an effort to put a thought into someone's head that is inaccurate. That would be, I mean, it's just wrong on every possible level. And what we're accusing people of in this case is nothing short of, I'm a weird person, and I believe, for my own weird reasons, that aliens are real and that they abduct human beings. And I'm going to just solicit and find people who are so weak-minded and mm-hmm. so lost that, you know, I have nothing better to do than to have them come and visit me and convince them mm-hmm. in hypnosis that this has happened to them because it supports my pathetic, distorted view of the universe. That is what it comes down to, yeah. in fact. And I will say I have certainly seen deep in hypnosis Bud lead someone, but always away.
Away from it, yes.
And they will, if it is factual, they will lead the individual right back and make the point clear. Mm. This is, again, it's such a pathetic level of attack, and that's really what they have. Let's attack the individual because...
You can't attack the data.
It's preferable to think that they're completely unscrupulous and for some reason have this weird psychological need that they spend their lives, and maybe they could be out there making money or something or having some fun, doing this with people for no other reason than their own weird ego gratification or... I don't get it. And I think for anybody, even somebody who is highly skeptical of the subject, if they carefully take a look at this line of attack, it really falls apart upon examination.
Yeah. And it was Dr. Simon, I believe that was his name, who hypnotized Betty and Barney Hill?
That is correct. Yeah. Dr. Simon was one of the first people ever, certainly that we're aware of in modern medicine, to use hypnotic regression to assist people in recovering and addressing traumatic memories. Mm. And in his case, that part of his work began with shell-shocked, as they used to call it, what we now call post-traumatic stress disordered World War II veterans, and trying to assist them in coming through the turmoil and horror that they had lived with them, and many of them had carried back into civilian life.
Right. And Simon tried to lead Betty and Barney Hill mm-hmm. away from alien abduction
yeah.
because he was skeptical. And he tries, couldn't it have been this? Wasn't it that? No, they wouldn't have any part of it.
No.
You know, same thing as Bud Hopkins is doing. Yeah. And, you know, that the show you were talking about earlier that...
Peter Jennings show.
Peter Jennings, yeah. Seeing is Believing was it.
Yes.
And Bud Hopkins, in fact, he told me personally, because I had him on the show, he yeah. told me that he anticipated these attacks
yeah.
about leading the witness and sleep paralysis.
Yes.
And he was ready for them.
Yes.
And they interviewed him for like 8 hours, and he said, you know, 30% of the witnesses,
yes.
Abductees,
they have memories.
They have memories. They are not asleep at the time.
No.
They're driving. They're at work. They're driving their car.
Yeah.
And you know. So maybe sleep paralysis can account for a handful of them.
Yeah.
But, you know, and maybe leading the witness can account for a handful of them, but not all of them.
No, and Bud wasn't exaggerating there. The amount of hours that they spent with him was extraordinary, and they did the same thing with Dr. Jacobs, both at his home and in New York at the studio. And they did the same thing with Dr. Mack. In fact, as I understood it from his assistant, the last full interview that John did with anyone was that interview for that show, which last time I was in contact with them was granted several years ago. They had not released to the John Mack organization that is now the current incarnation of PEER, his old research and study group. No, that material was omitted, and in such a way, and so calculating, that for me it's a lie by omission, and it was one of my main criticisms of the show. It was a terribly lost opportunity. You know, you want to do a show on UFOs, that show in particular had good production values. They treated the witnesses they had with respect. There was a feature involving police witnesses, always a plus for most folks that... You know, they represent authority, and they are trained observers, unlike those silly pilots who never watch where they're going. But, again, when you exclude that much information that you have and then say this is the solution without offering the hard information you've collected from the three, certainly the three or three of the then world's leading authorities and researchers on the subject, that's dirty pool.
Yeah,
and
is.
Again, stick with sightings if that's what you want to do, or some more esoteric aspect of it that's safer.
Right. And the sighting, you know, once people accept the fact that the UFO, the sightings, okay, the UFOs are here, we're being visited, wouldn't it naturally follow that they're not just here to put on an aerial show for us? They're here for a reason.
It would for most of us. And again, this is where we get into the land of the true Pandora's boxes within the boxes. 33 years into my studies in this, and I'm dismayed if I know exactly what's going on. I can ask better questions than most people, and I certainly have my ideas and thoughts about some of the scenarios. But I think it's, you know, most of us feel at this point that we're dealing with different thems who may be here with different motivations and different histories and relationships with the critters currently stationed on planet Earth.
Yeah, there are benevolent people and malevolent people and indifferent people all over the world, and why would you expect it to be any different throughout God's universe, you know?
Thanks, Dave. I appreciate that because even though I can't absolutely prove it, some aspect of this study suggests to me that they, in their various different types, are probably as capable or as active in terms of compassion and sensitivity as they are in pathology and destructiveness.
Yes. I think most of them are indifferent. I think
that more and more makes sense to me. There's a passivity, and there is a program of some sort that seems to be... indicative of this whole extremely disturbing abduction phenomena, and none of it is very settling.
No, none of it is very settling. But if you and I were to go out into space and find a planet with quasi-intelligent beings on it, like we have here on Earth, you know, what would we do? What do we do in the forest?
Well,
what do we do in the jungle?
In the 70s, the great anthropologist Margaret Mead spoke about this, and I'm glad somebody asked her the question while she was alive, and her first response was, I have no idea because I don't know how aliens think, but went on to say, and of course I'm paraphrasing, that she felt they were, at least by her studies, which were obviously limited, fairly passive and interested in observing our culture, the same way that an anthropologist might be interested in observing a ancient culture that we stumble on, you know, while we're looking for oil or gold somewhere in the middle of nowhere.
That's right. We'd want to see what makes them tick.
Yep.
And I think that's what they've been doing with us.
Well, or they've been working on the clock that makes us tick. And again, seeming to create a new breed of beings that seem to be part us and part them.
I think that's been going on all along. And they're
what it's leading to, we can only guess.
I think they've been tweaking our DNA for a number of years, if not millions of years.
Well, my DNA sure feels that way.
Does it? You can actually feel your DNA.
No.
Aha, we have an admission.
Uh-oh, that's that. You know, having caught me in that deception, I wanted to take 2 minutes of your radio time to just quickly discuss something, namely that in June, I was being interviewed on a competitive show, a show called the Paracast.
Oh, yeah.
And I was on with John Burroughs, a very important witness of the Rendlesham Forest case, and our hosts were hitting us with questions, as they're very good at. And I gave an answer that was absolutely wrong. And I'm taking the time on pretty much every show and every talk I do to just spend a moment and correct it, because I guess the good news was that it had been so long since somebody identified a factual error that I had given on the air that I don't remember the last time it was. But in this case, it was not an error with Left at East Gate. It was a mismemory of something I had researched over 20 years ago in the course of answering 2 hours worth of questions without notes, namely that Larry Warren, who was my co-author and the American hero who blew the whistle on the Rendlesham Forest UFO incident in the early 80s,
right.
Information that he had supplied was used for a Freedom of Information Act action that caused the release in 1983, as I recall, of the, 83, of the Halt Memorandum, the one-page memo on the UFO incident written by the deputy base commander, and that a copy had been sent as a courtesy to colleagues in England. And what I said on the radio was that one of those individuals, Jenny Randles, certainly one of the best-known and most prolific writers on the subject in the world, English, of course, that she had sold that document to the News of the World, a huge tabloid in England, and pocketed the money. And that was not correct. It had been done, but not by her, but by a barrister who was also involved in the case named Harry Harris. And, Jenny, I apologize to you, and I don't think that it's a good idea for anybody that works in this subject who appears on the air to make believe they didn't make an error when they did, and just to correct it and move on. And here we go into our last few minutes.
Very good. We're human. We make mistakes. We say things that are incorrect.
Yep.
I remember just today I was telling my wife that when I was a kid, I learned the word redundant. And it was a $5 word to me. And
a good one, yeah.
Yeah, and I thought it meant something that was very funny.
So, oh, no.
And so I used it in that, you know, oh, that was very redundant. And people would look at this kid and say, oh, my goodness. But even in ufology, we can be fooled.
Anybody
and
this
can be fooled.
This isn't even that. It's a matter of misremembering.
Right.
And not that it's ever happened before to me, and I don't expect it will ever happen again, especially as
right.
I get older.
Right.
That was it, and I just wanted to acknowledge it.
Yeah.
It happened before to me, and I don't expect it will ever happen again, especially as
right.
I get older.
Right.
That was it, and I just wanted to acknowledge it.
Yeah. It, right. Right. Okay, so we made one mistake, one time.
Hopefully,
I've been caught. So, Peter Robbins, where can we learn more about your work?
In just a few days, I leave for England. I'll be speaking at a conference in Liverpool. You can go to find information on it at Beyond Knowledge. That is the name of the conference. And I'm going to be spending time there with my new webmaster. So I'm sure with a quick Google toward the end of the year, you ought to bring up my new website. Otherwise, if you're in England next week in Liverpool, please join me there.
I'm sure we have listeners there.
October 10th and 11th, I'll be speaking in Philadelphia for Pennsylvania MUFON. The following weekend, the weekend of the 17th, I'll be speaking at the Monster Mash in Massachusetts. And then again, as we come in toward the end of the year, November 6th through 8th, please join me, if possible, in Las Vegas at the Crash Retrieval Conference. And the following weekend, a brand new conference called UFO Info Weekend in Cocoa Beach, Florida, where, with any luck, we will actually be seeing a shuttle launch from the hotel, weather allowing. And again, visit their website. It's a particularly interesting one, and it's going to be a bit of a departure for UFO conference. It's not just going to be a bunch of folks like me. For everybody like me, there'll be some television personality that you associate with something like the X-Files. So going to get you from both angles on that one.
Very
UFO
good.
Info Weekend.
UFO Info Weekend. Peter Robbins, thank you so much for joining us. Hope to do this again.
You bet, David. I'll look forward to it.
Good. And if you have any questions or comments for me, you can email me at dtwitchell@hotmail.com. And this show, as well as all the show forum shows, is now archived at whfr.fm's website. And click on the forum button on the homepage. We Are Not Alone is also archived at my website, ufoimplications.com. Stay tuned to whfr.fm, the station making waves, for the best in alternative programming. And I want to thank you for joining us today. Please join us again the first Saturday of each month at 10 a.m. when we will again explore the mysteries of the UFO phenomenon. And until then, this is David Twitchell reminding you to keep an eye on the sky.